Hello and welcome to Playback Daily. It's Friday the 9th of May. I'm Louise Herity and here's some of what's coming up.
I said, well, I'm not voting myself to stay in here. Like, this is like an entertainment show. I'm doing my best. I am putting in the time and I'm improving. It's just like, it just so happened that the year that I'm actually competing in it, there's two Olympians.
I think for preschoolers, don't overschedule it. They're used to a routine. They can still get up at the same time. But a lot of the time, they're easy to entertain once there are snacks.
They probably didn't hit it off immediately. And I know I knew Gay very well and, you know, really, you know, got on so well with him and was quite close to him, but Joe much closer. But they were quite alike in many ways. And I think they appreciated each other's talents.
On Morning Ireland, Cian McCormack reported from Rome the morning after the election of Pope Leo XIV.
And Cian, it's the morning after the night before in St. Peter's Square.
It is indeed. And, you know, I thought it would be quieter here this morning. Obviously, you don't have 40,000 people here, but the crowds are still here. The TV and radio crews are still here. They haven't derigged yet. So it's a different scene to what I was imagining last night before I came here. But last night, it was thronged here. It was just full of life. It was full of sound, full of celebration. Actually, where I'm standing right now, and you can probably see me on the news channel, is where I met two Irish women, Róisín and Afríc Ní Laoin from Dublin. And here's what they told me as they were heading off to celebrate.
We came specifically. So once we heard the news and the date was set at the start of last week, we said we can't pass up the opportunity. It's too close. Who knows when we'll get the chance? And considering how young this Pope is, who knows when we'll get the chance again? But we just decided to come. So we packed our bags, booked our flights and came.
How are you feeling now?
Absolutely over the moon. I'm very excited. I'm so thrilled that I managed to be here. It was a very exciting experience. It's just...
Well, Afríc, where were you when the white smoke came out of the chimney there in the Sistine Chapel?
I was about as close to the front as you can manage. We were right up in the top pen, so we'd been camped out now for a good few hours, and we were sort of relaxed at that point. Everyone around us, we were just singing and sitting on the ground, and then next thing you know, a couple of minutes later, the white smoke appears.
How did you feel when you saw it?
I almost don't know how I feel. I was just so excited because we arrived a couple of days ago and we've been here, you know, watching, and we've gotten two rounds now of the black smoke. So you never really know what's coming. And so the excitement, the fact that it just sort of happens out of the blue and there's just white smoke, and you just know that all these cardinals who have come together have made a unified decision. And
I'm a practicing Catholic, yeah, so it's obviously, yeah, look, it's a huge part of the faith that the, you know, whoever's at the head of the church, and it was something we were incredibly excited for, and I was delighted to be here. And you know, as Afríc said, one of the things that's so incredible about being here is you get a sort of an understanding of the global nature of the church.
Now you're leaving St. Peter's Square now. Mm-hmm. Do you celebrate tonight?
Absolutely.
How do you celebrate?
Yeah, we're going to meet up with people. We're going to go out. We're going to have a festive dinner. You know, we're going to have a few drinks to have the old Aperol spritz. Yeah, absolutely. It's a cause of great joy for Catholics. And it's a very exciting thing because, as I said, you're surrounded by Catholics 24/7 here. And that's a joyous thing as well.
Finally, sum up your feelings right now.
Hopeful for the future of the church, a vibrant church, an alive church, and a church that's centered on the tradition and the gospel.
Sum up your feelings.
I'm excited. I'm excited to have a new beginning, to see where a new papacy takes us. He's going to be a very young pope, so he's going to have, hopefully with the help of God, a long papacy to establish certain trends that bring us into the future.
Hopeful and excited, Róisín and Afríc Ní Laoin from Dublin there. Well, joining me now are Michael Kelly from the Church in Need and former editor of the Irish Catholic, and Father Kieran O'Mahony, Augustinian friar and biblical scholar living at St. John's Lane in Dublin, but here in Rome today. Let's start with yourself, Father. You know the Pope.
Yes, Bob Prevost was our superior general for two terms of 6 years each.
So you called him Bob?
We called him Bob. It's kind of informal. People don't realise how informal religious orders are and how democratic. We vote in our superiors and we vote policies every 4 or 6 years.
So he was your superior. Did he take time to travel to meet you in Dublin?
Yes, he did. Our superior general is a bit like the Queen of England, kind of a remote power really in our order. But he visits all the nations where the order is. And he came twice to Ireland in 2005 and 2009 to attend our National Assembly.
And what's he like?
He's a very agreeable, happy in his own skin person. He related very well to us. His interventions at our assemblies were sparing, but always very accurate and useful.
Well, you've had these personal conversations with him now going forward. I assume you won't be able to refer to him by his first name anymore.
Well, I did wonder about that. If I do get to meet him, I will say Your Holiness, but I'm going to call him Bob, I think.
What are his good qualities?
I think he's a very stable, calm person who thinks things through very deeply. And he's also very, very bright and nobody's fool. He's also stronger than he seems. He'd be able to make difficult and challenging decisions, I think.
And can you remember any specific conversations that you've had with him in the past year or so?
Well, I met him in November in our college just up here, Santa Monica, and I was at lunch there with the community, and he was there as well, and I went and said hello. And he came across as completely normal member of the order, actually, without any put on as cardinal and archbishop. He just related very normally to us all.
Were you surprised he was elected by the cardinals?
A little. I was watching because he has a lot of the qualities. Although he's American, he's really from South America. And as you know, he has Peruvian citizenship. And his experience of church has been shaped by South America, a bit like Pope Francis. And he's a very good linguist, as we saw, in Spanish, Italian, also Portuguese and French. And that will stand to him.
Michael Kelly, during the conclave, we were talking about potentially a pope from Asia or a pope from Africa. There was talk too about maybe the church moving in a more conservative direction. What approach could this pope take?
I think he'll be a unifier first and foremost. I think it was important that he emphasized last night in his remarks, the importance of unity within the church. I mean, he also spoke very clearly about the synodal journey. This is the process begun by Pope Francis of kind of co-responsibility within the church, or bringing everyone together involved in decision making. So there's a clear signal that he wants to continue with that. But the fact that he emerged as pope so quickly after only 4 votes, I think means that he must have really impressed the cardinals in the general congregations, because bear in mind, this group of cardinals, probably uniquely in human history, didn't meet each other very often under Pope Francis. A lot of them are from far-flung parts of the world. The Pope Leo XIV has only been here in the Vatican for a couple of years. So I think that's important. He obviously really, really spoke to the cardinals in a way that resonated with them during the general congregations.
Father Kieran, what's your view?
I noticed the speech last night. He used 3 words, very important words. He used the word pace, which occurred 7 times in his speech. He also used the word ponte, meaning a bridge, so to create dialogue. And he also used the word presenza, meaning presence. I think that really will mark his term of office.
Father Kieran O'Mahony and Michael Kelly, thanks for joining us here at St. Peter's Square. I think if anyone is watching on the RTE News channel, they'll see just how beautiful it's looking this morning. Well, Anya, that's it from here in Rome and from the Vatican, where there has been white smoke, which we obviously know, and there is a new pope. Pope Leo XIV is elected.
Ian McCormack reporting from Rome on Morning Ireland. There was a lot of coverage of the new pope across the radio today, and also another big story from yesterday, the news that RTE's Joe Duffy is set to retire on the 27th of June. On Morning Ireland, we heard a compilation of some of the highlights of Liveline over the years.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Tell us about the symptoms you had. I had cyclical depression. I had tinnitus with ringing in my ears. Mm. I had night sweats. I had flushes. I had migraine, migraine with aura. I had tingling. I had dizzy spells. I had all over body pain. I had vertigo. Towards the end of it, before I got better, I did become suicidal.
Okay. I've been given 2 to 4 years from diagnosis to live. The chemo is to prolong life, not to save it. I have 3 years tops to go. My husband has suffered right alongside me in his own way, knowing that the woman he loves will soon be dead. But today, when I heard that a very nice man who was in the same, if not worse, condition than me, when he went to his GP, is going to live because he had private health insurance and I'm going to die because I didn't, I had to bite my tongue. I'm happy he's going to live. He deserves to live. But so do I.
Temperatures here, 30 plus. As a veterinary nurse, what do you think of the idea of hanging a goat for 3 days in that weather?
I think it's inexcusable, to be honest, that they're thinking that it can go ahead.
Well, I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie. Certainly not for family viewing.
What would you see in a porno movie, Mary?
Well, I don't know, because I never watched one. I've just imagined.
Doc Savage is with us.
I was just saying there, there's three fellas in the pub down the country. The weather is good. You know, got locked into the pub one night. Got out about 4 o'clock in the morning. The fella looks up and says, look there, the moon is still out. The other fella says, no, no, that's the sun. So the other fella says, settle the argument, is that the moon or the sun? He said, oh no, I'm not around here.
We've been waiting such a long time, nearly 50 years. Now Johnny's here with Logan's Cheer.
Yeah, Grafton Street at Christmas, Susie Long, the menopause, all the people, the issues that Joe Duffy made such a difference with over the years, and Alex White, former Labour Party minister, former radio colleague, but most importantly, one of Joe Duffy's lifelong friends, is on the line now. And Alex, you've known Joe for nearly 50 years. You met in Trinity College and you were both involved in student politics. Duffelcoats, I remember then.
Yeah, well, it's extraordinary to be saying, you're talking about Johnny Logan 50 years ago. It is almost 50 years. I was 17 when I arrived in Trinity in 1976. And one of the first people I met was Joe Duffy, this just sort of incredibly restless, passionate, talented person, like a really assiduous student, but, you know, made an impact in Trinity, as you'll remember, Anya, and an impression that went way beyond being a dutiful student. He was a student union politician, as you and I both were as well. He was, you know, he displayed an incredible talent as a communicator. And I know that's almost like a cliche to say somebody's a great communicator, but he really understood it. He was 2 or 3 years older than me. He'd worked in advertising before he came to college. I think he picked up a lot of skills there. And he came into Trinity at that time in the mid-70s as, you know, we were not quite the first cohort of beneficiaries of free secondary education, you know, to come through into university. Mm. We were almost the first cohort. And it was really, you know, equality in education was a really passionate thing, and I think still is for Joe, and was for all of us in that time. It's sort of personal. And he worked so hard to advocate for education, to advocate for education. As we used to say then, I don't know if student politicians still say a right, not a privilege, but he believed that and fought for it, you know. So I think a lot of the talent that he displayed then came through in his work as a broadcaster. As we're just listening there, his feel for people, the sadness of their lives, the fun, you know, all of the different, the colour of people's lives, his ability to describe that, and his ability to shut up and let people speak, which was something that, a talent that I think that he's displayed so much also.
And he brought that sense of justice and empathy for outsiders, you know, through his time in the probation service, through his work as a producer in RTE when you worked alongside him. His close relationship, before I come back to Liveline, his close relationship, yeah, Alex, with Gay Byrne.
Yeah, we both worked with Gay. I actually left RTE in the mid-90s and went off to work as a barrister. Joe stayed on, as we know, and has been. Actually, Gay, I was just reflecting, Gay worked for 37 years on air, and that's exactly the same period I was just thinking that Joe, 27 years on Liveline, having worked 10 years prior to that. So same length of time as Gay. they were very close. And I think one of the reasons why they were so close was they had a kind of a very similar work ethic. It was almost like a sort of a Victorian sense of discipline, you know, getting the job done, taking it very seriously, being quite self-critical. I mean, never self-satisfied. And I think that they probably didn't hit it off immediately. And I know I knew Gay very well and, you know, really, you know, got on so well with him and was quite close to him, but Joe much closer. But they were quite alike in many ways. And I think they appreciated each other's talents. And Joe learned so much from Gay. I know that Gay appreciated working with him. So there was that kind of kindred, I suppose, spirit between them, that they had a similar approach to broadcasting. And what worked, by the way, like what it's a funny thing, you know this, Anya, and your colleagues, you know, it's not just about, oh, Joe used to joke, oh, well, we just answer the phones. And of course, it's not just about answering the phones. I mean, that's just, you know, because it's literally mediating. It's literally, it's understanding what will work as a piece of radio, what will fly, when to let the thing continue, when maybe to think, look, we had enough of it. And I think they both had those skills. And Joe picked up so much from the instinct as well that Joe had is very similar to what Gay had.
And briefly, Alex, the public and the private face, because like Gay Byrne, a public figure that everybody knows, but also a very private man, a family man.
Yeah, and he's an incredibly loyal person. I mean, he's got all of these, I suppose we all, well, coming back to the 50 years thing, we pick up friends in different stages of our lives, his Ballyfermot mates, his Trinity friends, RTE obviously, and so many other friends. Like, he's so loyal. Now, people are loyal to him, but he returns that loyalty. And all of his sort of quiet kindness is like, he'll send you a card, he'll send you books. And he's even doing that now. My adult children, the same age as his, he sends them books, he sends them cards. You know, he's a curious person. He's, as I said, a disciplined person, very widely read, intelligent guy. And I think that he'll find plenty to do now.
Alex White, former Labour Party minister and lifelong friend of Joe Duffy on Morning Ireland. Oliver Callan was also paying tribute to Joe Duffy this morning with a throwback to one of the most memorable Lifeline topics, the uproar over normal people.
And then, of course, Joe Duffy, very deftly and in a very classy, understated way, announces he's slipping out of the Lifeline in June. The Montrose monarch has abdicated. He's hanging up and deleting the country from his phone. It was a day of Pope and change, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, many people would have just been looking at the Lions squad being announced. No Sam Prendergast, but 15 Irish players. So it is very much the Irish and British Lions now. And by the way, Joe will be on the Late Late Show this evening. That's mainly to prove that he's still alive and not dead, because some of the tributes you're hearing are going, oh my God, is he okay? Still very much alive. At the very last Late Late Show of the season, or as it's being known for the conclavey week that's in it, Patrick Keelty's Room of Tears. Somebody bring the poor man a box of Kleenex. It's all too much for him. There's a mad lineup, by the way, on the Late Late Show, just announced in the last hour. Tom Brady, the Super Bowl champion 7 times, makes his debut on Friday. Of course it's a debut. It's an incredible guest to have on, the NFL legend Tom Brady, who is going to be sitting in the same room as Joe Duffy and Nadine Coyle of Girls Aloud. And of course she's one of the great Derry girls. Music from Emmy, who is representing Ireland in the Eurovision Song Contest next week. So that's the mad lineup. It's going to be absolutely amazing, last of the season. Sorry, it's just something in my eye. Get the man a box of tissues, for goodness sake. Memories of Lifeline obviously being discussed hither and thither, but the greatest ever episode in our view, and we've gone through everything. Lockdown 2020, remember that? When Normal People, the Sally Rooney adaptation on telly, landed on RTÉ, and people who'd never seen the level of friskiness among teenagers of the noughties lit up the Lifeline and they talked to Joe. Incredible. Strap yourselves in.
Well, it's described to me as the eagerly awaited adaptation of a novel, yeah, which I never heard of.
That's fair.
So
enough.
Naturally, I tuned into it. Well, I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie. Certainly not for family viewing.
What would you see in a porno movie, Mary?
Well, I don't know, because I never watched one. I've just imagined.
I got phone calls from two or three young married women in the parish here, and they have young children, young girls and boys, and they were horrified at that, and they said, what they can we do about this?
Yeah, you know? You know what they can do? They can pick up the remote control.
Exactly, of course.
I watched Normal People the other night, and I actually, as a 19-year-old, I thought it was probably one of the most realistic portrayals of, I mean, of everything that I've seen on TV.
Now, in Galway, places like that, they say girls are almost asking fellas to go to bed nearly on first dates. They think it's a natural thing to do, unfortunately.
Is it a natural thing to do?
Oh, it is natural, but not in that setting, you know. And in all fairness, you know yourself, marriage is the best place for it, isn't it, really?
No, I don't know that. I'm sorry.
The point is, it's filthy, in my opinion, and I won't be watching the rest of it.
Wash your eyes, 51551 was basically. And as ever, the greatness of it is that Joe Duffy's barely there throughout the whole thing. He's just in the background, gently guiding the whole thing. So enjoy the late, late Joe and the very long farewell all the way to the 27th of June.
That was Oliver Callan this morning. And also on the show, the visiting critic, where he asks a well-known person to step outside their comfort zone, was Chef Kevin Dundon. And his task was to try aerial acrobatics.
But all your life, do you try new things?
I do. I think it's important to take yourself out of your comfort zone and because it kind of it makes you more creative.
Yeah.
So I've gone to India, I've done yoga down there, and I've gone to retreats, and it's completely different from what we do every day of the week. And I always get something really positive out of it. And even on this week when we were in the air hanging out of ribbons and whatever, it was... first of all, I'm so happy I could do it.
Because it looks really difficult. In fairness, we've got pictures which I'll put up on Instagram later on. I presume they're already on your Instagram. Yeah. Well, tell us where you went, first of all. Where exactly do you do aerial acrobatics in this country of ours?
So in Dublin, so Exchequer Street, and it's aerial cirque.
Very good, yeah.
And it was Rita Murphy gave me a private instruction. And you walk into an amazing building. So it's the old kind of... Garment district of Dublin. So it's opposite Exchequer, you know, that old the pub.
It's very nice area down there. I believe you were sizing it up already as a restaurant.
I know, it's fantastic. But you had these beautiful stained glass windows, and it was it kind of looked like a church. And you walk in, there's five stations of these ribbons hanging from the ceiling.
Right.
I'd say the roof was probably about 30 foot tall. And you've got these ribbons. So,
which you learned later are called silks, are they?
They're called silks.
Silks.
There you go.
Very good.
And you're kind of looking at them going, okay, so what's happening here? I'm starting to laughing. Rhea, she was fantastic and really talented.
Yeah.
And so she kind of went to the ribbons and she said, you're just going to do... Oh, first of all, you did a 3-minute warm-up.
Very good. How do you warm up for
jumping jacks.
That's usually exercise.
Yeah, doing planks, hitting your...
Doing planks?
Yeah. Listen, after 3 minutes, I was done. I'm not going anywhere. It's you mean, after getting those silks down? I was already...
We're going to find out a lot now about you. How long can you hold your plank for, by the way?
Well, obviously 3 minutes.
You had a full 3-minute plank.
No. Fair. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Everyone's eyebrows are raising. So Dancing with the Stars has really tightened that core.
It has, big time.
Okay.
And I also do reform Pilates as well.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
anyway.
Because of the lower back issue. So that sorts that.
It has sorted that.
Yeah, yeah. And the dancing really did that because it's all about posture.
Yeah,
so I think it really worked.
So the 3-minute warm-up sounds exhausting.
Yeah, I was done at that stage. And then you go to the silks.
Oh, God, right.
And she puts a knot in it. So it's like a cradle, I guess, like a seat. But then you have to raise your hands above your head and really pull yourself up and into the seat. So you need upper body strength.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
you get in there. And then you put your foot under your other leg. And then you kind of stand up. Directly, it's very hard to explain.
It sounds really hard to do because you're pulling your entire body weight up off there.
Okay. Yeah, and then basically you have to have so much trust in the silks.
I presume it's all these crash mats.
Yeah, there is a big crash mat.
Yeah, but you don't want to use it. It's still going to be sore. Yeah.
And then you're kind of like you're floating. and spinning.
Right, oh my God.
It's actually quite cool. But what was really good is that there's no pressure on the joints. And it's like it's a really good kind of aerobic exercise. So you really feel as if you've worked out.
Do your legs go to jelly when you go up, first of all? I'd imagine that.
No, because if you do, you'd be on the ground.
This is usually done as a class, isn't it?
It's done as a class. They do, apparently they do a two-hour introductory class on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And also, it's you meet people at it. Like, they've already had one wedding through...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's like a dating opportunity.
Yeah, it's like speed dating. Because you work in pairs.
All the inhibitions are gone once you pull yourself up into a hanging ribbon, essentially. Yeah.
The worst part was when you actually throw yourself backwards.
Oh, God, right.
So yeah, and you're not holding on anything.
There's no...
So the silks are kind of wrapped around your legs and you're kind of swinging backwards. Down, so it's like kissing the Cashel Rocket Cashel moment.
The Blarney Stone, to me.
Blarney Stone, yeah.
Do you go upside down at some point?
Yes.
Right,
I didn't like that bit.
Oh, right.
Because I was, because initially you're a little bit concerned about your back, and I don't want injuries.
Yeah, which she knows about and takes care of, yeah.
But it was completely safe.
So how are you kind of knotted into the thing at that stage, or how do you hang yourself?
Yeah, you're kind of wrapped. It's not so much you're not tied into it. It's just like wrapped. And
right.
So it's
you did that once and said, "I'm not doing that upside down."
Did it twice. The first time I was like really quick. I let me at it, and then I did it again.
Blood rushing to your ears, kind of thing.
Yeah, and then, but it was good because the next time you kind of went up higher.
Right.
Like I got her, I said, "Can you please show me how it's done?" And she went right to the top of the ceiling. Just like spectacular. I'm not doing that. Not this time anyway.
As you pointed out, these are really high ceilings.
Yeah,
kind of 30
foot.
Church-like. Yeah. 30 foot.
Yeah, I would imagine 30 foot.
Did it feel great floating there at times when you got the hang of it and you knew what you were doing, I presume?
Yeah. I think I was... I was actually really impressed with myself that I could actually get up on the silks and actually float and do it. Too. She actually said I was very good, but saying that, like when I was doing Dance with the Stars, they also told me I was very good. So.
And whatever did they mean, Kevin?
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Okay, I will have no further questions. We'll come back to that in a minute. So there you are in the silks, trussed up like a prize turkey. All the trust in the fabric. It sounds like you love this.
Yeah, I was saying to Catherine that she would love my wife.
Your wife, yeah.
Yeah, she would. It's a great exercise. Mm-hmm. And
were you sweating afterwards? Did you feel like you'd done a workout?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. Time, yeah. But just after the first 3 minutes.
It sounds like you're going to do this again with the missus.
Yeah, I think it would be good to do it, Catherine.
Yeah,
actually, yeah. So it was actually a really good experience. I'd recommend anybody to do it. It was really, really good.
Excellent. And that's Rita.
Five star.
And it's what is it called again? Aerial Cirque.
Yeah.
In Dublin. And that was a 2-star thing. The class is good. You mentioned Dancing with the Stars. How are you feeling about it all now?
Yeah, it was good. It was quite the experience.
Yeah.
It was a lot more work than I ever thought it was possible. Like 4 to 6 hours every day for seven days a week.
And when did you start your training?
So this is a really interesting point. So you start the last week of November.
No, people don't realise this.
Yes. And the first show goes out the 5th of January. And you're dancing away. And they're coming in saying, "You're fantastic. And you know, I can't believe how you're getting this so well." And then you're on your second dance already. And it's like, I thought I was like in the top quarter of all the dancers in my head. And then you go.
For how long?
I know. Yeah, so you go on set on the 4th of January and you're in costume. You dance the routine.
Yeah.
And then you look back on camera. And you look back on camera
your head,
and you go,
"Amazing.
Oh, you've been lying to me. And so have you. And so have you." So I realised, okay, so this is it. And at this stage, you're live to the nation the next day.
It's very exposing. Yeah, it's wintertime. Everyone's watching.
Everybody's watching. So I had, okay, so it's 90 seconds of dance and 8.5 minutes of telly.
After so months and months.
Yeah, so let's concentrate on the telly bit and just get the dancing out of the way. Well, it is Dancing with the Stars, isn't it?
I suppose you were expected to be, given you know, every year people of the certain age, people go, oh yeah, they'll be gone in week one or two. You made it all the way to the quarterfinal stages.
Yes.
And became the story of Dancing. I don't even remember what else happened. Like, it was all about you. You probably didn't expect that.
No, I just didn't want to go out the first week because I think no one wants to go out the first week. Yeah. And but we actually went to week nine. So we actually learned 10 dances, which is quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And some of them were actually quite good.
Well,
and I improved every week.
The outfits that they made you do, yeah, cowboy, Shrek. The top hat, and the Shrek comes straight to your head.
Two and a half hours in the chair.
But it was done in the morning time.
It was done at 9 o'clock in the morning, so it was on the whole day. And what actually happened on that, that was the jive. If anybody didn't recognise the jive, I was doing the jive for the Shrek movie week. So you get into costume at 9 o'clock in the morning and that full makeup, and it's like a prosthetic that goes over your head. So there's no way for the heat to get out of your body. So I was taking my shoes off, so the heat was going out of my feet. But there was a bit of a malfunction on the makeup because it was on so long, and I was in the chair right up to the second I went on live to dance. And so we started off dancing, and every dance you dance, you start off on your left foot. On this particular dance, you start on your right foot.
Right.
And I started off my left foot, so I was lost. So I said
to her... gone from the first step.
From the very first step. So I said to Rebecca, I said, I don't have a clue where I am. She's shouting at me, counting me in like 1, 2, 3. And I said, no. I says, Shrek's about to go rogue.
For 12 hours in this bloody thing.
And he went rogue.
That's incredible dedication to the because you're a busy man. You have done Brodie House, which is a very busy establishment. You have lots of other things going on, books and actual cooking and chefing away. That's amazing you put so much time into this.
Yeah, well, I agreed to do it last May. So I blocked out my diary.
Why did you leave it till November to start it?
Well, you weren't allowed to. Well, maybe I should have.
Well, I think some people got years of dancing lessons. I've mentioned those. But the Shrek moment is special to you, I believe, even still.
Yeah.
It's the screensaver on your phone.
It is, actually. Did they just tell you that on the phone?
Were we supposed to know that? I'm not sure.
I love it.
I think we just broke GDPR rules.
It does move to other images as well.
I was hoping you'd reveal it first, but moving on.
Yeah. That memories will stick in my head for a long time.
One of the memories for us, because it's obviously painful for you and it's very difficult to dance as you discovered, is just the amount of fun that we have out of this show.
Yeah.
And to have an entire episode of Live Line, and everyone's talking about it since Joe and Nancy's retiring from it. That was, did you listen to that episode?
I listened to it afterwards. He actually sent me a lovely painting.
Joe did.
And also a card saying, keep dancing, Live Line listeners love you.
That's because he felt really bad.
I say so.
He felt really bad. And also, it was amazing radio.
Yeah, it was fantastic. The national treasure.
People were complaining that you were such a divisive figure and you shouldn't have been there at the competitive end of dance. That must have hurt, though, at the time.
Well, it did for about a day.
All right.
Because I said, I'm not voting myself to stay in here. Like, this is like an entertainment show. I'm doing my best. I am putting in the time and I'm improving. It's just like, it just so happened that the year that I'm actually competing in it, there's two Olympians, active Olympians.
Yeah. It's a tall order, wasn't it? Yeah.
Not a hope. But I was kind of happy they showed up because there was a dancing competition at the end of the day. So
you got over, you kind of look at it differently now, it seems like, do you? Experience.
Yeah. The Joe Duffy moment.
The whole thing, the Dancing with Stars and the madness of the Joe Duffy moment.
But then when you think about it, the whole of the nation, besides one person, got behind me. kept me in for another couple of weeks.
It kept you in for a long time. Were you actually disappointed on the night when you had to exit?
No, I think if you had asked me at the start of the series that I was going to get to the quarterfinal, I would have taken your hand off and said, brilliant. Right? But then when you get there, it made sense that I went, and I went out in a high, and I was only gone a week, and I was back then for the final, so it was perfect. But there is a side of you saying, oh, I wish I could have just stayed to the semi-final.
Yes.
But I reckon if I got to the semi-final, I could have gone to the one, and I possibly could have won. And then that would have been a complete
disaster.
Against
a gold medalist?
No, no, but just like public vote. Because it's only down, it's literally just down to the public vote at that point.
It is, okay. Yeah. I see what you mean, yeah. That would have been a disaster. So much went on in that. Joanna Donnelly is one of the biggest stories. In fact, the week the poor Pope died, she was a bigger story.
She topped it.
Of her announcement. Can you shed any light at all that's legally broadcastable?
No.
Does that mean you don't know anything? No,
no. I do, but I don't say.
Okay.
No, Joanna's great. So
you're busy anyway at the moment these days.
Very busy, back doing our second series of Under the Grill, our podcast. So that's...
I've been on it.
You have been on it. Yeah, you did really, really well.
Is the idea the same for everyone? They get a childhood favourite meal and...
Yeah, and we talk about it. And like
you cook it?
Yeah, I cook it. And then we talk about it. And we go down all different avenues about food and brings everybody back to...
You're enjoying that.
Yeah, childhood memories.
Chef Kevin Dundon, the visiting critic on Oliver Callan's show this week. We're almost at the end of the school year, it is hard to believe, and it's the time when parents turn their attention to organising the activities and days out for the summer months. Parenting blogger and influencer Sinead Fox joined Claire Byrne with some tips.
Now is the time to think about this, isn't it?
Well, maybe 6 weeks ago was for some of the stuff, so uh-oh.
Yeah, because we're so reliant on the school routine, so are the children, and then we get to summer and panic stations, so we need to have things booked in.
Absolutely. It's 8 or 9 long weeks if you have a primary school child, and it's an extra 4 if you have a non-exam secondary school child, which we'll get to in a bit.
Yeah. And the problem is, if you've got children of different ages, you know, it can be hard to sort of manage that as well.
You need a village.
Yeah.
Like, I think nearly summer holidays is more important. If you, like, when I book my primary school child into a camp, I see, has she got a friend who's maybe going through that we can, you know, share lifts one way or the other, because you can't be in 3 places at 10 o'clock in the morning. Or 4 if one of them is work.
Yeah, this is the problem that faces us. Will we start with the preschoolers?
Absolutely.
Then? What have you got for them?
So I think for preschoolers, don't overschedule it. They're used to a routine. They can still get up at the same time. But a lot of the time, they're easy to entertain once there are snacks. That has been my experience. So once you have the raisins, the breadsticks, the rice cakes, whatever it is, it usually works. So they can be easily enough entertained at home, first of all, if you figure a few things out. Get a few outdoor supplies, sandpit, have a safe outdoor area with a bit of shade, and provide food that wasps don't like. Wasps are the scourge of outdoor play.
Yeah, raisins. They probably like raisins, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly. Or the little sticky rice cakes with the fruit, the juice on the outside of them. But pavement chalk is a really cheap and good investment that they can play away for ages. And you can just hose it down, and as long as there's no hose pipe ban, and start again the next day. We used to do a game with ice where you get like little bits of toys, not favourite ones or they get upset, but little kind of, you know, things that come in Happy Meals or in Christmas crackers, and you freeze them, put them in your freezer in a lunchbox, and the kids can hack away at it, and you can give them like different little tools, like a spoon or
hours of entertainment guaranteed,
until one of my kids realized that if you walk over and drop it, it smashes on the patio. We got a good few summers out of that before they realized that.
So big days out then as well, if you plan a couple of those over the summer.
We always try and do a zoo or photo trip. We kind of do it every other year, and they're lovely days out, and you can do it at your own pace. You're not, you know, and it's outside and there's playground stops. And sometimes my kids they used to prefer the zoo part or the playground part than the animal part, because there's brilliant playgrounds in those kind of places. And with COVID, they're all reopened as well. But farms, there's a lovely Gruffalo walk in Wells House in Wexford. I always push Wexford. Malahide Castle is lovely. Places like that have a bit of something for everyone, especially if you're trying to bring older kids and younger kids to the same place.
Now, let's move on then to the primary school children, which is a great time for camps, isn't it, at
it
that
is.
Age?
It is. That is the absolute target age for camps. And they're the ones, I suppose, the kids they're big enough that they're able to concentrate in camps. They have enough energy to stay at a camp all day in the heat. So Cool Camps is probably the biggest known camp, the GAA Cool Camp, the widest one. And the furore when the Cool Camp goes up and it gets booked out and there's panic stations, and different counties release it sometimes on different days. So that has been quite stressful. I'm happy to say I've secured a place in our local Cool Camp. You have to be very careful you haven't booked your school or your summer holidays to miss the local Cool Camp as well, because nobody's going to the rival club's Cool Camp. That's not going to happen. a lot of people kind of look at the big ones, like they look at the Let's Go, they look at Star Camps, they look at the ones that are nationwide, but there's a lot of local ones, smaller ones, if you actually kind of pay attention to your local Facebook groups, to your notices in the supermarket, you'll find that maybe if your child does gymnastics, they've got a club, or maybe music has a camp, or there's different ones that go on. There's a lovely art camp that's run and crafts.
It's a good time as well to try out an activity.
100%.
You know, if your child has expressed an interest in, let's say, gymnastics, do the summer camp, see how you get on, and then we'll book it in for September.
And keep an eye on those. There's also really good swim, like if you want to kind of skill them up, Swim Ireland and Water Safety Ireland both do weeks if they suit. And this is the thing. You might want to do 6 camps, but during the 8 or 9 weeks, but they're all on the 1 week, and that can happen. And that's where it gets kind of tricky to pick and choose.
Swimming's a great one because I'd be exhausted then in the evening.
Some of the swimming ones only last an hour.
Oh,
so by the time you drop,
short.
Yeah, you drop them there and collect them, it's a disaster.
We need them to be long. But again, good days out for that age group, going to a couple of museums or galleries, just maybe two or three over the course of the summer.
We do a Dublin day out. Now, we're Coolshies. We're from an hour down the road. And we sometimes get the train, so then it takes 2 hours to come up. But we do a little Dublin day out where everyone gets to pick something we do. I pick a museum. You can go in and see the mummies. People don't realise there's actually mummies in Kildare Street in the museum. The Dead Zoo is still closed for refurbishment, which is a pity because it was one that the kids always loved. There's a bit of fun in it. Collins Barracks has some stuff. Like, have a look. You don't have to bring them to every exhibit. My kids would have had a kind of a 45 minute to an hour.
Yeah, dip in and
dip in, have a look, and maybe look at it beforehand to see what things you want to see.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know that there's a tank or there's a gun or there's something that you think your child might be interested in, that's the place to go.
And even if you live in one of our beautiful cities, act like a tourist
for a day. 100%, absolutely, because there's lots to see and do, and it doesn't have to be expensive. Like the galleries and the museums are free. The Heritage Ireland do heritage sites all over the country are free on a Wednesday, and there's some really good ones on it that you might not think about, or you might, because days out can be expensive, and it's a good way to kind of target it, that, well, actually, first Wednesday, why don't we go there because it's free. I had a list of some of those, but there's so many of them, it's just difficult to even to even cover them all. But like somewhere like Ross Castle in Kerry, if like a lot of kids have never really been inside a real castle. And JFK Park in Wexford, again, that's a great one for the southeast because it's a big playground, there's ducks to feed, there's a lake, there's a lovely nature walk there. Charles Fort in Kinsale, again, the kids, their imaginations can really run away with them there.
Now we come to the teenagers, and this is, I'd say, the trickiest group to keep entertained. Do we have to entertain them all summer?
No, we absolutely don't. They have to learn how to be bored. But that is not to say we shouldn't occupy them.
Get a job.
So I've got 2 teenagers, and it's hard, and to be fair now, it's hard to get a job if you're under 16. It's hard for employers to employ them. They have limits on the amount of time they can employ them for. So, you know, it's difficult to get a job if you're under 16. In a lot of areas, it's difficult to get a job if you're over 16. But let's get them ready for the workforce. So if they're at home and you're at work, or if they're at home and you're entertaining somebody else, I love to give mine tasks. And I say, right, you can play your PlayStation, you can hang with your friends, but do something for me first. Contribute to us. So my cutlery drawer is absolutely gleaming. We'll do the cutlery drawer maybe one day, or somebody will take out all the delf out of, and just, you know, where the crumbs go and you wipe things out, or maybe spray the patio, or maybe do a little bit of weeding out the front. So they're learning life skills. If the washing machine is on and you're going out, who's going to hang it out? Of course, a 14-year-old is well able to hang out.
Do you have to bribe them to do that?
100% not. They get enough. You know, Mum, can I have money in my Revolut?
Oh, you're good at this.
You
know,
yeah, but just you learn, and it makes my headspace better. When I come home, I have time to do other things with them because I'm not looking at the things that haven't been done.
Yes.
Now, I'm not saying that they're...
So give them a couple of jobs, but are there things they can do that are like the camps but more advanced for
absolutely.
That age group?
Well, they can help at camps, which is one of the things.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the... If your local soccer club, rugby club, GA club is running a camp, they love to have the teenagers in. Now, there may be Garda vetting for some of them, depending. If they're over 16, they'll need to be vetted. But our Cool Camp, for example, my son has helped out with that a few years. Golf clubs are actually really, really good value for junior members. My middle son joined the local golf club last year, and again, the friends, they share lifts down to it, and they're gone for 4 hours.
Right.
Now, I don't know what I'm training him for in that, because then he'll be somebody who disappears for 4 hours quite a lot. But it's really good for them. They get out there in the fresh air, they're learning new skills, and it's a really safe place for them to be as well, that they're not kind of, you know, hanging around the place.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something that we found great. But they need to have time to hang out with their friends as well. And I think that's important. But we also, I insist that they do attend some family days.
A couple
out.
Of jobs, but a bit of time to hang out with with the friends and maybe an activity or
They'll
two.
They'll be working
along
the way. Long enough.
Parenting blogger and influencer Sinead Fox on Today with Claire Byrne. And you can find Sinead's blog at Bumbles of Rice. A Nicolas Cage movie directed by an Irishman was among the films reviewed on last night's Arena with Sean Rocks, and the reviews were from Tara Brady and Declan Burke.
We'll start with The Surfer. You always have to check, I suppose, Tara, when you it's a Nicolas Cage film, which mode is he in for this particular outing?
Well, I think Nicolas Cage, I mean, there's one mode throughout his career that you can rely on. And if you think back to the very peak of his stardom, it didn't matter if he was in David Lynch's Wild at Heart, and it didn't matter if he was in a conventional romantic comedy like Moonlight with Cher, which was a great film. But he always had that kind of barely suppressed rage thing going on. And what's really great, I think, about the late Nicolas Cage career is that he's really leaning into that. And he's doing a series of increasingly unhinged roles in which he gets to be increasingly unhinged. There have been films like Dream Scenario, if you remember that one, Declan, from where he starts appearing in people's dreams and everyone really loves him. And then the dreams get a bit nightmarish, and then everyone really hates it. And he's finding his way. He's finding projects that really like suit this, in which he can go properly bonkers.
And
all
it, has,
the way through.
It has to be said, in the case of this film, The Surfer, Declan, you can understand his rage, and it is rooted in a more realistic place, I think, than many of the previous Nicolas Cage's rages were rooted.
Yeah, we're in a fabulous setting here. Where the character Nicolas Cage is playing the surfer. He's back in his old childhood home in Australia, Luna Bay, where he has all these wonderful memories of surfing the waves, and it was where everything was possible and so forth. So he has taken his young son, his teenage son, out of school to play hooky. They're going to surf the waves,
and they are simply referred to as the surfer and the kid.
That's their names, according to the script. And it's you know, it's going to be a wonderful afternoon, but as you said, are thwarted by the Bay Boys.
Right. Yeah, well, let's have a listen to a very early encounter. And the Luna accent is fairly thick, it has to be said, in places, and certainly in the case of some of the locals. But you'll hear Nicolas Cage, they're making their way down to the beach, and a guy kind of just bangs his surfboard off the young fella as he's walking past. And from very early on, you get a sense that, none of this is happening by accident.
We got to get out there, though. It's the best place to show you my big surprise.
Oi! Uncle's army!
Look, it's quiet out there. We'll respect the line. We won't drop in. Kid's a fantastic surfer. Just wait till you see him.
Don't live here. Don't surf here.
I grew up here.
Don't live here. Don't surf here.
Hey, Dad.
It's okay. You're scaring my boy. Get out of my personal space.
Don't live here. Don't surf here.
There you go. Don't live here. Don't surf here. Fairly clear instructions there to Nicolas Cage as the surfer, and his son Flynn Little in the background there with the local guy kind of making it clear to him, Tara Brady, where that he just isn't wanted. And that just seems like a little bit of territorialism, but it gets worse and worse as the film progresses. He goes to the coffee shop and he's basically, manhandled out of the place and the coffee's thrown over him.
Well, like this leans into the really classic exploitation films, as they call them in the 1970s, like movies like Wake and Fright, where someone who's a bit too pommy for the locals' liking would end up in the outback, and the outback town isn't remotely appreciative of them. Now Nicolas Cage is not at all pommy, it must be said, and they barely make any excuse for his accent. I think there's some point about, I left here during childhood, so he could just be Nicolas Cage. Yeah. But there really is a sense of menace around, like particularly with Julian McMahon, who's absolutely excellent in it. And, he's a character actor; he's knocking around for years, but he's really genuinely terrifying as the kind of leader of this pack. Mm. And there's a sense that there's some kind of weird religious cult, and you're not too sure what's going on. But also, it really plays with what's happening in his mind and what's actually happening to him, and how much of this is real and how which is imagined, and you're genuinely not sure. So it's incredibly unsettling to watch, and the fact that it takes place under this baking hot sun for most of the runtime as well is really really disconcerting. Because it's the kind of horror scenarios that you're expecting to happen, you know, at night in a creepy forest or something like that.
And one of the interesting aspects, I think, beyond all of this kind of horror thing which is there in the background for sure, Declan, Nicolas Cage, the surfer, is there with the kid, his son, so there's a father-son relationship there, and without giving too much away, we realise that there's a Nicolas Cage has a son, and his father, that relationship is kind of discussed and pursued. Nicolas Cage is wearing a watch that his father's given. The surfboard that he has is his father's surfboard. So there's something from the past at him as well.
Yeah, very much so. There is a tragic backstory that is frequently alluded to as we go through, and we won't give away too many spoilers. But the character, the surfer, he is absolutely determined to reconnect with this idealized, this mythologized world that he has of his childhood years, because he thinks that's going to make his current life
perfect.
It's going to fix everything. And of course, we know that it's not. But as Tara says, we do get these kind of almost flashes, surreal crossovers between what he believes his life is and what other people, how other people see, you know, what he truly is. And as it's unsettling, as Tara says. Reminded me in ways of Vivarium, which was, I think,
again, Loughran Finnegan's
strongest film to date.
Irish director here. Yeah, I remember he spoke to us around the time. I think he was filming this film, The Surfer, at the time he was last in with us.
Very good.
You were saying though that it feeds into that same theme.
It reminded
as
me of a similar kind of transition between a kind of a cold hard reality that we're looking at this beautiful landscape, and then we get this very fuzzy perception of the world through the character of the surfer's eyes, and it's very effectively done.
Stars from you, Declan.
I think it's good, it's enjoyable. I think I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Solid 4. And I think we're getting the good Nicolas Cage for sure here. Yeah. What starts from you, Tara?
Yeah, I think it's Lorcan Finnegan's best film today. Yeah, 4.
Yeah, that's great to hear. So The Surfer, directed by Lorcan Finnegan, 4 from both Tara and Declan. Let's move on then to The Wedding Banquet. And this is a remake, a remake of a fairly recent film, essentially, Tara. Remake isn't probably quite the right word, is it?
that would be an ecumenical manner. It's a reimagining, I suppose, is what we call it, to use studio speak. But you're right, it's a really strange idea to remake a film from like 1993, which, if you're me, just felt like, you know, just 5 minutes ago. And it's not an obscure film either, because it was a big breakthrough film for Ang Lee who's an Oscar winner, and it was certainly, like, I remember it being a kind of staple of the DVD store, so you know, it wasn't overlooked. It won awards, it was a big thing.
It was a kind of a mainstream film at the time,
the central idea was it was a bisexual Taiwanese main character who was living in San Francisco with his long-term male partner, and suddenly the elderly parents come over, so they have to put together this sham wedding, and at the end of the film, there's this absolutely brilliant moment where the father presents his son's male partner with a bridal envelope, and it's actually just such a
very
lovely
touching moment.
And you realise he's been wise to them all along.
So this is that's the Ang Lee film. So we're in modern day Seattle for this one, Declan?
Seattle, and it's very firmly set in the Asian American LGBTQ community, and that's an integral part of the story. We have Angela, who's played by Kelly Marie
Tran. This time we have two gay couples.
A lesbian couple, Lily Gladstone and Kelly Marie Tran. They're desperately trying to conceive. They're in a long-term relationship. And then we have Bowen Yang and Hang Chan, and they're a gay couple, and Min is kind of on sabbatical in America from Korea.
And nobody in Korea knows about his gayness or his gay relationship.
Certainly not. And he comes from a wealthy family and so forth. Very conservative background. And effectively, to cut a long story short, so Min proposes to Angela so that he can pay for their fertility treatment, and in return he gets the green card that allows him to stay in the States and not go back to Korea. Oh my God,
but
I got all that.
Granny in Korea is not going to be happy with that. She's still going to want to come over, Tara.
Oh, well, she does come over. But I mean, here's the problem. It's one of the reasons why I was going over the original plot, is that in order, they're trying to make this concept work in a world where it's not at all taboo to be an LGBTQ couple. And you have these two couples who are very kind of very sitcomish and who are like walking in and out of each other's houses, and there's very much that vibe. And so when Granny arrives, and Granny's played by Young Jung, who won an Oscar for Minari a couple of years ago, she actually gets very quickly on board with the sham marriage for an unseen grandfather who never appears. But because that's the case, and because they've tied themselves in knots in order to kind of make the plot work without the sham wedding being a sham wedding, there's not really that kind of tension, and there's not really that kind of like screwball energy that you got from the first one, where they're frantically trying to cover.
Yeah, and in the clip that I'm going to play, I think you get a sense that this, instead of going the screwball route and sticking with it and giving us a rom-com, they start to go into kind of serious mode and about where these relationships, the two relationships and the paternal, maternal relationship, could they help to conceive the child, where all of that starts to become a source of rouse, effectively, as you will hear in this clip. They're all shouting at each other and they're using a lot of bad language as they're doing so.
Talk about stupid, unsafe sex. Hey, I'm talking to you. I mean, how much more of this do you expect me to put up?
That hate you.
Shinny, the fact. Put down the fucking phone and listen to me.
So where do you get off? This whole thing was your idea, you fucking busybody. Wei wouldn't even be here but for you. And I wouldn't have to deal with any of this shit.
Shit! I'm shit! You're a shit!
I wasn't calling you shit.
Don't call me anything! You user! You fraud!
Ah, shit!
Is it Wei Tong forgot to pay rent? If
you don't speak, no one will consider you a fool.
There we had Bowen Yang as Chris and Hang Ji Chan as Min, the two male the two members of the male couple, and Kelly Marie Tan as Angela, who's one of the lesbian women, and they're all tearing strips off each other. Obviously, the Korean in-laws are watching all of this. One of the interesting sides to this too is that Angela, the lesbian woman who's in this open marriage, her parents know about it and her mother's right behind her, and when Angela starts explaining to the mother, "I'm going to have to pretend that I'm married to my pal, the gay man that you know," the mother's appalled that she's covering up in that way.
She is absolutely outraged. Her mother May, who's played by Joan Chen, is not just an ally, but she's so enthusiastic an ally that she's actually embarrassing to Angela. And she, as you say, she's outraged that her darling lesbian daughter might even consider deigning to marry a man.
Yeah, and for all of that, it seems to fall between then the two stools of screwball comedy and let's have a bit of fun and a nice romantic ending, and trying to treat the issues seriously, Tara. What does that mean in terms of stars and overall for you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't think it worked. I didn't think it worked at the level of the narrative. Technically, it's all over the place. You're just there going, why is the camera over there? Like, there's like really strange shots and edits. So by any metric, it's kind of a bad film, but it is very sweet and small, see, and I do love Bowen Yang and Lily Gladstone, so we'll give it a three and let it be.
Tara Brady and Declan Burke on Arena with Sean Rocks, and you can listen back to the show in full on the RTE Radio app. Well, that's all we have time for on Friday's edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.